Hey guys, my name is Dan Silveiro. I'm 27 years old and I sell millions of dollars of athletic apparel.
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
Dan, what's up, man? Welcome to the show.
What's up, guys? Pumped to be here. Thanks for having me.
Last time we chatted, you were on your way to a jungle exploration over in Tulum. How was that?
Good times. Good people. Yeah, we went with some friends and my wife, her co-coach for the high school team that she's coaching, and then her significant other who played basketball at BU. And normally I feel like I can compete, you know, in any sport. This guy absolutely embarrassed me. Made me look like a good child. We played a little pickup and I was like, holy crap. So
how long were you guys there for?
We're there for a week. Yeah.
Just hearing the fact that you're playing sports down in Tulum, I think we had different Tulum experiences. But I like the fact that now we're on a podcast and I see Henry Ford and Gandhi in the background. So definitely playing two different cards and two different sides there, man. I'm excited to have you on. I know Austin connected us and you've got a really cool story. Everything from the way you grew up, the sports you played, and now the fact that you're kind of turning one of your passions into a really successful business. So I just want to probably kick things off starting about like how you even gotten into lacrosse in the first place. And then we can kind of bring it all the way around to where you're at today with Signature.
Yeah, definitely. So just kind of a background. I was always a three sport athlete. I grew up in South Florida in Jupiter. I played basketball, soccer, football. And I didn't actually end up picking up lacrosse until eighth grade. So our football coach came into the locker room, dropped some sticks on the ground and said, you guys are going to play this in the off season. And when I first picked it up, we maybe had one or two guys on the team that had ever played before. So they're teaching you how to cradle the stick and just all the wrong ways of playing. But it was a lot of fun. And I think that year we probably did 80% of our practices were like a modified Oklahoma drill. Whereas like they throw the lacrosse ball out and you guys just run into each other as hard as you can. So it was really a good intro to the sport and I really enjoyed it. And then I was fortunate to have some really good coaches after that. I was asked to leave from that school actually. And that got me into the public high school there. And we had some amazing coaches that had just graduated from Duke, won a national championship there. And then I ended up playing travel ball and had a really amazing guy who Andrew Boulder, who ended up being like a second dad. And that coaching led me to commit to play Division I lacrosse up at St. John's in Queens, New York. And while I was up there, I had this idea for a better lacrosse ball. All lacrosse balls were the same. We wanted to make a better one. And that was really what launched Signature Lacrosse and the whole idea.
So when you say better lacrosse ball, I feel like I played lacrosse all throughout high school and I don't know if I could answer like, well, what makes a better lacrosse ball rather than your generic one that's on the field?
So that was kind of the whole idea. So I was actually stretching in high school, a ball ricocheted off the post and I had played a lot of golf living in South Florida and there was always different levels of a golf ball. And so there's like a premium golf ball and then like a regular golf ball. And then like the practice balls that you hit at the range. And when the ball ricocheted off the post and I picked it up, it was like, man, all these lacrosse balls are the same and they don't last more than like 2 weeks before they get hard and they become shiners or greasers or drill killers. You probably called them in high school. So, yeah, making the ball last twice as long so you get more out of every rep. And then in doing that, we stumbled upon the fact that like in order to do that, you had to lower the compression deflection, which is essentially the amount of force and pounds it takes to compress a ball down to 25% of its height. So it's really like the hardness of the ball. So if you imagine like, you know, your buddy right next to you punching you as hard as he can in the arm. And if he punches you with his full fist, there's a larger surface area on impact. So there's less pounds per square inch of force transferred. So it doesn't hurt as bad. But if he punches you with his knuckle, you're going to get a dead arm. because all that force is coming into that one point on your arm. So by lowering the CD of the ball, the compression deflection, it actually made the ball softer. So on impact, there's a larger surface area, less pounds per square inch of force transferred, actually makes the ball safer as well. So we weren't trying to make it safer, but it was like a huge win when it just so happened to become safer.
Yeah. And I feel like every single high schooler's mom hears safer lacrosse ball and like, okay, cool, I'm in. But dude, what did you study when you were over at St. John's?
So I studied finance and accounting.
Right.
Double majored. And I just really love finance.
Because I asked that question because I remember when we were talking before, like as you're describing like the physics of this lacrosse ball right now, I'm thinking to myself, I was like, oh shit, like did I get his major wrong before? Like what I wrote down. But I think if I'm correct, you found like a rubber chemist on LinkedIn and actually like just cold emailed them or cold outreach to them saying like, hey, listen, I've got this idea for a lacrosse ball. How do I actually go and make it better?
Yeah, a guy from Shell Oil, really, really good dude. And he taught me, I mean, I'm just insatiably curious and I just wanted to learn about all this stuff for whatever reason. And now I know way too much about rubber lacrosse balls. But yeah, I was really fortunate to get introduced to him. And then he helped us come up with a better manufacturing process and then a better chemical composition for the ball.
At what point kind of playing lacrosse or sports were you like, oh, we can maybe turn this into a job and actually make money? Or did it end up being, hey, I just want to be able to make a better lacrosse ball and see what happens. And then, you know, the business part came after.
Yeah. So growing up, I lived with my dad and he always made us pay rent. So in order to stay at his house and eat his food, we had to pay rent. And our choice was like work in the yard side by side for like $6-$8, whatever minimum wage was, or come up with a way to make more than minimum wage and then use that. So after I got to like 14, maybe I started to realize like, no, I was probably like 12. Me and my brother were like, there's gotta be a freaking better way to do this. So we started hawking mangoes. Like we'd pick mangoes off the tree, set up a little stand and then sell them back to all the neighbors. Like anything we could do to make more than $6 an hour. And then eventually that led to doing private lessons for kids. So I was doing, once I committed to St. John's and in South Florida, there wasn't really a lot of like Division I committed lacrosse players. So that built a lot of authority. And then we were able to start offering like private lessons and it's like $60-$80 an hour per kid per session. And I think the first week I did that, I was like, this is way better than $6 an hour. So
way better than hucking mangoes.
Yeah. And like, I mean, hard labor. And my dad is he pushes you. So he taught us some really great values and just I think we're really fortunate to have been raised that way. And we always just wanted to make our own way.
We're looking back on it now, because when I hear like you had to pay like rent when you're in high school and stuff like that, I don't know. I'll just speak with personally, maybe it's from privilege or like I just didn't have to go through that kind of stuff when I was in high school. Like my parents didn't make me do that. At the time, were you like resentful of that? And looking back on it now, like were you grateful or like how do you view that entire situation?
So I always appreciated it. I think I always wanted to do it my own way. And I think I remember so vividly getting in so many like arguments with my dad, because what he would do, he was the king of this. My friends, our house was like the house everybody would go to. We would all go out on Friday from the time we were like 12, 13. Like we would go out, we would have a good time.
Yo, whoa, were you guys going out when you were 12 or 13? Like the roller skating? Like
going out, but like going out, hanging out with friends. Until
like Mountain Dew and pizza outside of 7-Eleven kind of going out. Yeah,
like, you know, probably getting into a little bit of trouble, but like, you know, just like normal stuff. But then in the mornings, on Saturday mornings, he would always come into my room and it didn't matter how many people were there. We got a list of stuff. And it was like, go out in the yard and clear this list before you're able to do anything on Saturday. And so as soon as we would get close to the end of the list, every time to a T, he would come outside with another freaking list. I swear to God, it was like the most annoying thing in the world. So, but we would get into arguments about stuff. Like we had, you know, it was like a 4-acre property with like a ton of shrubs and like trees. And like, we had to take down the trees. We had to take out bushes. There's poison ivy everywhere. Like you got to wear long sleeve shirts and jeans and like duct tape the stuff, or you're going to get infested with ants and like poison ivy. So it's like, I would always say, like, you know, we have this riding lawnmower, like I'm just going to carry the, all of the stuff with tie a rope, drive the riding lawnmower, work smarter, not harder. And he was just like, absolutely not, put it over your shoulder and take 20 trips and do it that way. And it was just like,
so he just like, he just intentionally made it significantly harder for y'all.
Yeah, he wanted us to put in, he wanted us to learn a work ethic. He was very intentional about teaching us a work ethic and showing us that like this stuff is important. And I'm really grateful for it. I'm incredibly grateful for it. Yeah, I would not have become a Division I lacrosse player if it wasn't for having a work ethic that he instilled.
And how has that influenced you now in the sense of like, are you out there just like consistently outworking your competition and just like waking up at 5 a.m. every morning and all that kind of stuff? Or does it change how you think about business?
So it really helped me understand that like I don't have any unique skills or unique talents. But what I can do is work harder and put in more time than other people. So when it came to lacrosse, I picked it up in eighth grade. I was super late to the party, but I would put in an unbelievable amount of hours. And like every time I was out playing wall ball or shooting around, it was like 110%. Let's get the most out of every rep possible. And I think taking that same, seeing that that was successful, and I ended up getting an All-American, becoming an All-American in high school, and to be a two-time All-American after picking it up like 2 years before that was pretty unique. And so once I saw that, like, if you're just willing to put in more effort than other people and you can get those reps faster. And then I think I read the book, you know, about like 10,000 hours and you become an expert. And I was like, this makes sense. Like, that's why I just put in way more work. So when it came to business, getting started early and early and often, we say all the time, it's like, get started early and just do it as much as you can and just get as much experience built up as fast as you can. And you're going to be that much more competitive and that much more of a, you're going to have that much more of an advantage.
So at what point did you actually kind of go down the, you know, full-time or more scaled out business? Was this still while you're in college?
Yeah. So after my freshman year, I really decided like I don't want to go play pro lacrosse. I really want to focus on the business, and the Division I athletic schedule was pretty crazy. So there really wasn't a lot of time. Maybe 2-3 hours a day I was able to put in to like working on the business. So I decided to transfer. I ended up transferring to University of Tampa. And while I was down there, the business really started to grow. We got up to like north of $1 million in sales and had our third or fourth employee come on full time. And it was around the end of my sophomore year where I went to my dad and I said, like, look, I know school was always like super important. My parents both wanted me to finish. But we had a conversation about it. And it was basically like, you know, school in general is meant to help you kind of find what you're passionate about. And once you find what you're passionate about and you know what you want to do with your life, you should go for it. And I was going to have to make the decision to drop out or to stop playing lacrosse altogether, which would have potentially meant that I don't get my scholarship anymore. I didn't want to take on any student debt for going to these classes. It didn't make sense to me because I would have these like 30-minute meetings with a mentor and I would learn more in that 30 minutes than I learned an entire semester. And it was directly applicable to what I was trying to do and the questions I was trying to get answered. So fortunately, he was open-minded to it and he gave me the go-ahead and it was game on from there.
Before you even had that kind of transition? Did you realize in college that, hey, I'm probably going to figure out something else? I mean, it seemed like at some point you ordered just, was it a bunch of lacrosse balls and said, hey, I'm gonna figure out if I can try to sell them all?
Yeah, it was. So after my freshman year of college, that summer, I instead of getting an internship, I wanted to get a sales gig because I knew I could, if I was just commission only, I'd make way more money than I could as an intern. So I was actually leasing copiers in New York City.
That sounds like my absolute nightmare.
Yeah, door to door, like 100 doors a day. And like we had business cards that said like,
What does that even mean? Like, well, you're just not like an office store and you're like, hey, do you want a
business? Yeah. Yeah. Figuring out like what they're getting past, you know, the getting past the gatekeepers, going and talking to the decision maker, finding out like what their lease terms are and how we could save them money and get them a better product. Like the whole just cold sales process. And
did you lose like 15 pounds that summer? I'm just imagining walking door to door in New York City, like every single office building.
It was ridiculous. We did a lot in Long Island, but it was when we would go into the city, man, like the freaking sun just pelting off of those buildings and then hitting you and you're in like a suit and it's like,
ooh,
I naturally sweat a lot. I'm Italian. It's like, man, this is not a good look. So, but yeah, I fell in love with it. I like the whole sales process and just cold calling and cold knocking on doors and just building relationships with people. I thought it was so much fun. It was such a challenge. And that really taught me how to sell. And then we ended up, I did fairly well. So made enough money to buy the first container of balls. And once I bought that first container, that was-
What does the first container mean?
100,000 balls. And so it's like, we're going for it. And it was like the entire summer's worth of money that I had earned. And I thought, you know, I'll sell this container in 12 months and I'll make enough beer money for school. And I ended up selling it in like 30 days. And that's when I was like, huh, maybe we got something here.
All right. So I need to unpack that for a second. But before I do, the one thing I wanted to quickly say was for anyone listening to this right now, I think in the past, we've asked a lot of guests before, like, give us sales advice and like, what did you learn about sales that made you better than you are now? And recently I watched this YouTube video with this guy, Alex Ramosi, who does like a bunch of like acquisition work and finds customers. And he has a good quote that basically says like sales is like sex in the sense that like you can read all about it and as much as you want, but like until you actually do it, you have no idea what anyone's talking about. And so I do think anyone listening to this right now who wants to go and like get better at sales, like we can ask you like, oh, like, how do you find the decision maker? And like, what are their good closing like statements? But you just have to actually sell. And then you get the advice, like go try to like close 100 customers on anything and then read a book about it. And then you're like, oh, the stuff in the book actually makes like way more sense now. So that's just like a little tangent there. But the big thing I want to kind of ask you about, because when we were chatting before, when you ordered 100,000 balls, like the first thing that comes to mind, not even is like, how did you sell them? We'll get into that because that was a cool story. But like, where did you keep them? Like,
yeah.
Like, did you just have a nightmare of an apartment for 30 days?
No. So I had called a ton. I had built a ton of relationships through selling the copiers because the best bucket of people to sell to is always, it's not your first connections, it's your first connections. So people you're once removed from. And so I had talked to all my first connections, of course, like that was the first people I called. And I was telling him like, yeah, you know, I'm trying to make enough money to really go for this lacrosse ball idea here. And one of the people that I was talking to, she's a good friend of my mom's. And she had done like some products, like she had done patented some products and then brought them in over from Asia and then tried to build a couple different businesses. And she explained like the concept of a 3PL to me. And I was like, wow, that's incredible. And then she introduced me to her guy down in, I think it was like Fort Lauderdale. And so as soon as I finished up in Long Island, as soon as I was done, I flew down and like 2 days later, a container arrived in Fort Lauderdale. And my brother and I actually went down there and unloaded the whole thing. 860, 12 by 15 by 10, 40 pound boxes. And it was a hell of a workout. And we ended up doing that 10 or 15 times, which was way too many times. We should have done that, but we made it a fun thing and like put on some music and see if we could get it unloaded in less than 2.5 hours. So we didn't get a $35 chassis fee. So it's like, just, we made it fun.
And so you were just unloading them into a 3PL and just assuming that you'd figure out the
like a pseudo 3PL. Like okay. This guy like basically rented out like a 2,000 square foot space and said like, yeah, I can ship this stuff out. And I don't even know if he had like a proper like ship station or anything set up, but he figured it out and he got the product in and out and it was good while it lasted. And then a year later or so, I was like, we should bring this in-house. This could be a good margin booster for us if we did our distribution ourselves. What a fool's errand. Like, that is so much harder than it sounds. So it was a great lesson. But ultimately, we ended up going to a bigger 3PL that we use now up in New Jersey. And just that whole selecting a 3PL experience is it's a nightmare.
Yeah, I've heard almost nothing but horror stories of that stuff. When you were first starting off and trying to buy 100,000 lacrosse balls, I'm curious on how you vetted suppliers, but more than anything, like you said, you kind of went into this thing with like just looking for some beer money, making some cash to kind of like kick off some summer savings or whatever. How much money did you guys make on those first 100,000 balls?
We probably sold them for around 150 grand and our cost was probably like, at the time, maybe like 80 or so.
Damn. Okay. So that's a lot of beer.
It's a lot of dollar beers. Yeah.
And so basically then you went from selling copiers what were you selling again in New York?
Leasing copiers. Yeah.
You went from leasing copiers, which in that summer, any rough inclination in terms of how much you made that summer?
I made like 100 grand. I could have made a lot more.
Leasing copiers. You made 100 grand.
Yeah. I mean, dude, I did what? Really well. I did really, really well. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not gonna lie. This is not the story I was like gonna take us down for a second. I was gonna be like, oh, like you went from 12 grand to like making 70K in like 30 days.
I came into that. I'm super competitive. I mean, sure. Like to a fault competitive. And I came in that summer and I was like, I'm gonna be by the end of the summer, I'll be the number one salesman here. And I told everybody that. And all the sales reps that had been there for 25 years and had books of business. And like, I was like, I guarantee it. And I made bets with everybody. And like one of the bets was like, if I hit this, then you got to take me and like a girl out in a helicopter ride around New York. Like ridiculous bets.
Yeah.
So since you made 20 grand in commission and then 80 grand in net profits on betting.
Yeah. No, it was like 50% commissions and yeah.
Holy shit. I would have never expected that at all. I was gonna say that also, that's a good lesson too, in terms of like when somebody wants to go and do something to you, just like tell everyone. Everyone's very timid on telling goals and like what they're trying to go and work on. But I will say from an accountability standpoint, you want to go and get in shape, go tell all of your friends you're gonna go and get in great shape. Venmo people like, you know, $100 and then they send it back to you if you lose the weight at the end of the month or whatever it is. Like actually having that public accountability helps so much. So respect you there, but I think more than anything, I kind of want to figure out a little more of this leasing copier game now. That's like a totally separate tangent.
Yeah, it's a good little market.
But the cooler thing, man, is like the fact that you also then flipped and made 70K in 30 days, essentially. And want to talk a little bit about how you actually sold all of those balls, because that's a really cool story too.
Yeah. So when I was first starting to do it, I started just calling all my old coaches and selling them the balls. And then they introduced me to people and so on and so forth. But then there was another really great bucket of people, which was all the coaches that had recruited me. So I had a drawer in my, where I grew up in my home, that was just filled with like letters from colleges. And I just called every single one of them and said like, no, I'm not going to transfer, but buy these balls. And then they all thought it was hilarious. I had a good pitch down. The lacrosse community is super tight. So people helping people, everybody wants to be a part of it. It's a beautiful thing. And so they would introduce me to other people. And then ultimately we became like we work with over 300 colleges now. So we work with like the majority of the market. We've sold over 10 million balls. So the ball thing worked pretty well. And then that's when we started getting into sticks and goals and taking that same like problem solving approach. So like there was a problem with the balls, all the balls were the same. We wanted to make a better ball. And then when it came to the sticks, it was like, all right, I coached for ever since I started doing those private lessons. I coached from then on. I loved I've always loved coaching. It's just a great way to clear your mind and go do something selfless and give back to like the community. And I usually coach the younger kids. So like 6, 7, 8 year olds, every time I was restringing 29 out of 30 sticks, the 30th kid, I would just give him my stick because I was so tired of restringing these sticks. And so when we decided we were going to make a stick, nobody ever focused on a junior stick because it's the lowest cost in the market. There's not a lot of margin, et cetera. And we were like, well, you know, if you do a really good job with a junior stick, kids will, it'll probably actually increase the rate that the sport grows at, because I can only imagine how many kids, and I've seen it firsthand, show up on day one trying to play lacrosse. You're using your hand, eye, and your feet at the same time. It's a hard sport. It's like hockey, really hard sport to learn. And then if they're throwing with a stick that I couldn't even throw with, and I played Division I lacrosse, like how are they going to have a good experience with the sport? So if we can make a better, like a junior stick that comes pro strong right off the shelf, it's like game ready and anybody could use it, then the odds are it's going to increase the retention in the sport. It's going to grow the market, and that's good for us long-term. And then what's the likelihood, like their second stick, their third stick, that they go back to signature. And so we started with just like focusing on the junior stick and making it the best we could possibly make it. And then released like a full size stick for that second, third, fourth year player. And now we have our pro line for like college, really elite high school and pro players coming out.
Did you ever really look at the demand side, I guess, originally when you first had your, I don't know, 100,000 balls? In my mind, just seems like a wild amount to order and then just kind of hope you sell out. Were you contacting people beforehand and being like, hey, if I order any of these, are you guys going to buy them? Or you just kind of went for it?
I try to pre-sell everything. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And so did you have some of those sales then lined up before you started ordering the balls and then as you expanded product lines?
I'm sure we did. I'm sure I did. Yeah, I'm sure half of it was probably sold before it arrived.
But now you guys kind of shifted out of just simply the ball and equipment game. And if I remember correctly, I want to say it's because you guys did some deals, like you struck up like a private labeling deal with Under Armour, and then like, you know, 3-year deal with Cross Unlimited. And like, you guys got like some really big names starting to work with you, you got their attention. But then if I remember correctly, you shifted away from that because it wasn't as good of a business as you might've thought.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically we were selling a ton of lacrosse balls, like millions of balls a year. And we still do. And through that process, we realized like, this is going to be a really great business for like two guys. But it's not something that we can really scale the way that we believe the way that I've always wanted to scale. So kind of the North Star that I have, my dad would always say, like, he wasn't a religious guy, but he would always say a prayer that me and my brother would have a positive impact on the world. And so that's always been like a North Star for me. And then finding a real passion for business and deciding that this is going to be my vehicle and I want to build $100 million revenue companies and have a positive impact, that have a positive impact on the world. That's what I want to do. So with that as like a North Star, figuring out like how the business model needs to be designed to be able to even have that potential. We started to look at like just the market cap in lacrosse and specifically in the ball category. And it wasn't until probably 2 years in where we really started to look at that, like, what is the total market cap? What does that even mean? And like all the different pieces of the puzzle that you have to put together to really build a business model. And so we had always been told kind of in school, like build a business plan. But it's the same thing as like, you know, if you don't sell, you can ask all the questions in the world and read all the books, but you're not going to know how to sell. If you've never actually built a business. You could write all the business plans in the world, but until you get punched in the face a few times, like, you're not really going to have a good business plan. So it was through that, just getting punched in the face time and time again, that we realized, like, we really have to pivot what we're doing. And so first it was pivoting from that private label model where we were private labeling for like Under Armour, Lacrosse Unlimited, and then shifting to like signature branded balls and really pushing that. And then we realized, like, this isn't a big enough market, so we have to expand our product categories. That's where we went and tried to solve the stick problem. So now all of our sticks come pro strung, game ready, right off the shelf. You order it, you take it out of the bag, you can pin corners with it. It's great. And then a quick connect goal, instead of stringing the net to the goal frame, you screw ours in. It takes 5 minutes instead of 2 hours. And that was actually like a personal thing. I had to string a goal one time. It was like 2 hours on like burning hot turf field in the middle of the summer in Tampa. And I was like, there's gotta be a freaking better way to do this. So after that, we started to look at like the economics of it. And I was pretty good at inside sales. I learned how to, you know, build the call scripts, build the touch point processes, train sales reps, hire, all of that. So that felt like the most natural like growth strategy for us. And when we're just selling a product catalog of really like three products, and we're selling it really to the retail market at first, we pretty much consumed like the whole retail market, and it was still like, it wasn't that much. And like the economics of it weren't that great from a gross margin standpoint, because there's so many people in the value chain. And so that's when we took a step back and we were like, you know, we should really be selling and owning the relationship with the end user. So let's work directly with the programs again, go back to like kind of our bread and butter. Right now we're working with a ton of colleges and retailers, but what if we also worked with youth programs and high school programs and really didn't put as much of an emphasis on like the retail market? And we saw like a net positive gain for the whole business, because of the most valuable piece of it was the feedback loops that we started to get from like the end user telling us like, this is my problem, solve it. And once you really know that, it's like, it's so much easier to build the right products in the right colors, in the right pack sizes, to really like solve the problems for your end user. And so around that time, we started to realize like, this is a great model. This is a great, but there's something missing. Even when we were closing 3 deals a day per rep, they're still not really able to build a personal wealth for themselves. And so that's not really going to last. You know, maybe guys will stick with it through their 25, 27, maybe, but by the time they want to like get married, have a family, like you can't, this isn't going to work for you. And so, we were fortunate to have a youth program, a local youth program we were working with. They shared their P&L with us. And when we took a look at it, the number one expense was apparel. And so we started to ask them like, okay, well, you're a service-based company, right? You're providing an opportunity for kids to play lacrosse. They register for your program. They come out, they learn the sport. You're a service company. Why is apparel your number one cost? That doesn't really make sense. And they were like, you know, well, we include the cost of the uniform as part of the registration fees and blah, blah, blah. And that's a pretty standard practice across sports. And so we asked them like, well, what if you didn't do that? And they're like, I don't know, let's try it. And so we tried it. And it turned out like we were selling to programs for, you know, 300 sets of uniforms at the time. And it was like, a super discounted rate, 30%, 40% off. But then when we started selling directly to the parents and they were buying the uniforms, we didn't have to discount it so much. And so basically the program director, that program ended up making an extra 20 or 25 grand that year, just dropped right to the bottom line. They were able to use that money to scholarship kids that actually needed it. None of the parents had an issue spending $100 on 3 pieces of fully custom apparel. If they went to Dick's Sporting Goods, they'd spend more than $100 and none of it would be custom. So, and this is stuff that like ends up being the kid's favorite thing in the world to wear. Cause it's like a pride thing. They're, you know, you remember when you were growing up and you got your new uniform or like you just wanted to wear it like nonstop when you were sleeping in the shower to every birthday party you went to. You just wanted people to know that you played this sport. So
dude, that's such a good point. I saw some tweet the other day about this brand called Varsity Brands. Do you know them at all?
Yep. They're a bigger player in the space. Yeah.
So what's crazy is that like, I think they do a lot of stuff. I don't know if it's cross sport. Is it mostly all cheer?
They do a lot of cheer.
Because I saw somebody tweet about this other day where they're just like, hey, listen, like my niece or something like that basically just bought a uniform, a bag, and like some pom-poms or whatever, like whatever you need for like a basic cheer set, and spent $1,100 just on one person. And then you start looking and you're like, okay, like who the hell is selling this? Like, how is somebody paying $1,100 for like a fucking cheer uniform? And you realize it's Varsity Brands, who does like almost all of the cheerleading events and apparel. And then when you look to see who owns Varsity Brands, it's Bain, like Bain Capital. And you quickly realize, wow, people are spending a ton of money on this apparel stuff. So like, is there one big player in the lacrosse space right now that's doing it that you're basically trying to go head to head with?
Signature.
Is no one else doing this?
No. So we have a very unique model. We're first to market with it, and we're on the front end of like a much bigger trend that I think is going to happen across the apparel industry. It's basically like the early adopters that were really taking a ton of that market share. Everybody, this problem has plagued the team sports world for forever. And it's basically like ordering custom swag, team swag and uniforms for programs is a nightmare. It's just a miserable, miserable process. There are a lot of players in the space, like BSN is a big player. They're over $500 million a year in revenue, but they all do it this old school way where basically like you as a program director collect all the information from your parents and then you send it to a sales rep. The sales rep sends it to somebody who they think is the manufacturer. It's actually probably a sourcing agent, who then sends it to a manufacturer. That manufacturer probably speaks another language, so they have to translate all the order information into their language. And most of them don't have an ERP or an information system. So they're taking this Excel sheet and like basically using that as a purchase order and then using that to like track manufacturing. And it's just like an archaic process. And then they bag everything up, put it in a big box, send it over to the sales rep. Usually it's a retailer, so they don't have a lot of experience with like QC because they're a retailer. Like the brands are the ones that deal with the QC stuff.
QC quality, for anyone listening, quality control.
Yeah, quality control, sorry. So they get the box into the retail, they just slap a label on it, send it to the program director. Program director like spends hours at night, and my wife went through this. So I was like watching her do it. I was like, this is miserable. But basically bagging everything up so that, and making sure it's all there so they can go out to the field and hand it out to all the parents. Well, if a size is wrong or the last name is spelled wrong or something happened, which it always does because there's all these people in the value chain and it's the classic like telephone game, who does the parent get upset with? The person who handed them the freaking uniform. So the program director, who has nothing to gain in this process at all, just gets yelled at from their client over a mistake that is inevitable because of the value chain. So that's really the problem that we aim to solve. And the way we did it is we signed programs up to a 3-year agreement. As part of that 3-year agreement, we get exclusive rights to merchandise their logo on equipment and apparel. We set them up with a custom team store. They're 24/7, 365. Our stores never close. There's no minimum order quantity on anything. As parents register for the program, they come onto the site, they order their uniform for the season, they buy a bunch of other team swag, and then it all gets made on demand and drop shipped right to their door. So we built a software that essentially allows us to automate the creation of production ready art files for dye, sub, cut and sew manufacturing with personalization on the product. So I know it's kind of a mouthful, but it's basically a cool software that makes manufacturing easier.
But from the consumer side, that you essentially gave these kids the opportunity to have their own in-house merchandise shop, right? With their name on it and their logo. Like, I feel like that'd be pretty cool. You pull up the computer, sitting there with your parents, like, oh, I want, you know,
yeah,
a bunch of these, and they're getting into fights on how much they can order of the the swag.
Wait, on that note too, I just read out that like the cheerleading average order value is like $1,100. What's a typical lacrosse average order value?
So cheerleading, I'll just like make a quick note on, is a ridiculous market. It is just like a unicorn anomaly of a market. And Varsity Brand, like they bought all of the cheerleading event companies.
A big cheerleading monopoly.
Yeah, they really have done a great job of like cornering the cheerleading market. And that's just a unique market. It's like a mix of like, I mean, first of all, I don't want to talk that, like that sport, if you've seen, like it is incredible how athletic these girls are. And guys, like the cheerleaders and gymnasts, that whole like sport corridor is really, really good athletes. But I think from a apparel standpoint, like they kind of get taken advantage of because the $1,100 order value, like that's insane.
But especially if you have like a 9-year-old daughter and she's like, "Dad, like, can I get this new outfit?" You're like, "Fuck, all right, like here we go, Bain Capital."
Yeah, right.
How are you guys viewing the kind of sports industry now? So you hit lacrosse. Are you gonna start doing other team sports? Because I feel like it just kind of fits in line with, you do soccer, football.
Yeah. So it's always been in our growth strategy, and so it's like dominate lacrosse first. We're well on our way to doing that. And so now it's field hockey this year and then soccer, basketball next year. And then we'll be in all sports by 2024.
That's cool. Okay. So you have a very big like strategic plan of how, and I guess when I'm thinking about this, lacrosse makes sense, a little bit more niche growing sport, field hockey, a little bit more niche growing sport as well. Soccer and basketball are fucking huge. Like, are you going after them because you think that you'll just have the economies of scale and you'll be able to like just tap right into those markets by that point? Or why choose those?
It's really problem solution oriented. So like, where does our value prop hit the hardest? And it really hits the hardest with program directors. And it's a sport agnostic problem. So it's really like across all team sports, everybody struggles with this. And so we opened up we raised our first round of funding. We did a public offering, a regulation CF offering. So we could raise money from both accredited and non-accredited investors. And it was actually insane how many program directors in not just lacrosse, but other sports actually invested. And it wasn't like a lot of money that each of them were investing, but it was like, this problem just resonates so clearly with everybody who's ever dealt with it. It sucks.
I think you mentioned like going into it this year, right? So you're starting to maybe change a little bit more so away from just the equipment side. I think if I have my numbers correctly here, 2022, you guys are projected to hit about 5 million, 60 coming from apparel, 40 coming from equipment in terms of like the actual breakdown. Do you have an idea in terms of where you guys will be come 2024, 2025, or like at least what you're trying to project?
Yeah, it's $100 million annual revenue 2026, and then we'll look at some sort of a liquidity event. We have a pretty well dialed in financial plan, and it's a bottoms up forecast. We have all the data to back, like our client acquisition costs and our speed of growth and what we need to do to accelerate it. We have the management team in place, so now it's like every hire adds incremental revenue. And so we're in a pretty sweet spot. We're really excited about it.
What does the team look like right now compared to a couple years ago?
Wild difference.
You got Austin. Does Austin still work for y'all?
No, but amazing guy. We had, when I first got started, I just hired all my buddies on my lacrosse team. So it was like, if you could imagine like a boiler room with literally a coffee pot and like 1,000 square feet, and we're just hammering the phones. Like that's what it was. And now we're over 60% women run company. That wasn't by design. It's just, we hired for who could do the job the best. And it just so happened to be a lot of females. And we have now, a proper ops team. We have a proper product development team. We have a marketing team, and then we have a sales team. We have an accounting manager on board, which was probably the biggest life-saving hire ever. Just like knowing your numbers and having them dialed in and being able to get your financials within 7 days of the close of the month. Like that stuff is so important, and you don't even realize it until you're really in the game that like you need that. You need to know the score. Otherwise you can't win.
What does that actually look like from a numbers standpoint? How many like sales reps versus operations people do you have?
We have four sales reps now, and then marketing, two folks around marketing, two in design. We're acquiring our first factory. That'll add another five people. And then on the op side, we have about four people. So yeah, I think we're around like, honestly, I would have to double check, but because we're in the middle of an acquisition that'll add five people, but I think we'll end up around like 19 or 20.
Okay, good for you, man. I want to kind of take a little bit of a turn on this conversation and maybe wrap it up on like a little bit more of like a relatable note for maybe some people listening to this podcast. When we were chatting like a month ago, I wrote down two quotes, and if you don't mind, I'm just going to read them out real quick because I thought they were like very powerful. Or basically you said, if it wasn't for certain coaches in my life, I'd be dead or in jail. And then you also said you were basically depressed until you found business, which is now like your North Star. And I think one of the problems that I sometimes have with us doing this podcast is like some of the guests like are having incredible success in their 20s, but they were also totally born on third base and just naturally had like a really easy life, and things kind of always worked out their way, which like I'll admit that's definitely a fault and something that we're trying to get better at. But I think from your story, like you had a lot of adversity and stuff growing up and going through college and high school and all that kind of stuff. And I think now the point where you're at, you're running, you know, $5 million a year business. You employ 19 people at the end of this year. You're trying to build a nine-figure, $100 million plus business. Was there something that changed in that time, or like advice that you might have gotten from a coach that totally shifted the trajectory of your career? I think there's a lot of people that might be listening to this right now that can relate.
There was, yeah. And it would probably be good to front load this on like the front end of the podcast so people know. But I don't want to take away, like there are people that have so much more adversity than I had. I was very blessed to have, you know, two loving parents and a dad that like beat core values into us. But the biggest changing point for me was like learning that I always was very competitive and I always had goals. But once I set a goal to be an All-American, like at first it was like get on varsity football, right? And then in Florida, like football is like everything. So then it was like, all right, I want to be an All-American. And then once I hit, you know, varsity football, I like started to get into a depression, and I was a freshman and I was like, why am I depressed? Like I have all this amazing family, all these amazing friends. I've been lucky with the ladies, like no reason at all to be depressed, but for some reason, like I feel like this, I don't know what it is. And then like I started to set my eyes on being an All-American, and I was so consumed by that I like lost track of like the depression. And then once I hit that goal and I realized like I didn't have anything after that, it was like, holy shit, I'm depressed again. And I have no idea why. And like, I feel worse that I'm depressed because I shouldn't feel this bad because I have all these great things. And like, there's people that have it so much harder than me. But I just kept like battling with it. And I was a really bad, bad kid. Like I got kicked out of two high schools and didn't make great decisions. And then one day I like finally like told my dad about it. My dad was like, did not respond the way I thought at all. So he lost it on me and was like, how fucking selfish of you. How much are you just thinking about yourself? And like, all you have all these people around you that are pouring into you and like all these great people, and you're just going to spit in their face and just like throw it all out. And like, who are you? And like, I was like, holy shit, who the fuck am I? Like that is really selfish. I have a really selfish perspective right now. And that was when it was actually like around my sophomore year, And that was when he actually was like, you know what you need to do? You need to go do community work. You need to go do something that's not about yourself. And that's actually when I went to a local youth program and coached, and then that was how I met the person who did my first private lesson. And then I fell in love with business. And then it was like just this incredibly fortunate path where like that bit of adversity actually ended up leading me to what I was really, really passionate about. And now what like my life is consumed by, other than my beautiful wife.
Wow. That's honestly not at all what I would have expected from your dad's feedback or whatever. Like I would have been like expected from a dad, like, oh yeah, don't worry about it. Like things are going to get better. But like sometimes it's the tough love you need, right?
He slapped the shit out of me. I was like, wow, I woke up. That was like a day that I won't ever forget.
That's really good advice.
You got a great story. I think people are probably going to want to keep following along as you build out this massive company and tackle all of these sports segments. Where can people find you? How can they stay updated with what you're doing and see what's next?
Yeah, my LinkedIn is probably the best. So Dan Soviero, S-O-V like Victor, I-E-R-O, dash Signature Athletics. You can find me on LinkedIn and follow along the journey. And I really appreciate you guys having me. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. We'll link to everything in the show notes below. And thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes.